I'm Elliot Lester, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya, how's it going?
Pretty well, pretty well. Hey, it's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who is on the show today?
Today we have a director. We don't usually, we don't avoid directors, but we don't often have directors.
And we have
an amazing director named Elliot Lester, who made a film that's coming out on, I think it might already be out on VOD. It had a limited theatrical. It's called The Thicket. And to me, one of the most interesting things about this is it was made by Tubi.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, nice. I am used to Tubi making like the Tubi originals being on the lower budget level. I know at least two people who've made Tubi films. I'm not casting aspersions on anyone who wakes up in the morning and makes a movie for Tubi, but I was a little surprised that a movie that has like stars of this caliber and production value of this level was made by Tubi. And I think it's an interesting move that Tubi is maybe moving in. Like, I could see this movie getting nominated for Oscars. I could see this movie. Wow. Yeah, yeah. I think it's a really good movie. It's called The Thicket. Looks great. Looks amazing. They shot it in the freezing, freezing cold. Elliot's got a great story as a director. Started out as an AD. You don't really meet a lot of people who started as an AD. And he was a very prominent director in sort of the boom time of music videos in the early 2000s. But his first job in the entertainment industry, if I'm not misspeaking, was he was a first AD in pickups on American History X. That's right. Wow. He started as a first AD for Tony K, not a director known for being a chill person.
Wow. That's truly trial by fire.
Yeah.
He is famously a screamer, famously difficult. Famously, bad up, bad down, as they say.
Joe Pitka busy that week? No, let's go with Tony K. All right.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm very excited. I haven't heard this interview yet, and I haven't seen the movie, and so both of those things are exciting to me.
The movie's really good, and I think one of the things that's going to blow people away in this movie is an amazing actress, Juliette Lewis, in a role like you've never seen her do anything like this in your life. And she's just amazing. But also, the cinematography is amazing. Peter Dinklage is in it. Peter Dinklage is amazing. Like, it's a freaking brutal Western. I would say if you've seen Bone Tomahawk is a brutal Western that leans more on being a horror movie. This isn't a horror movie. This is a Western in the mold of The Searchers. But it kind of lets you know what it's like to live in the most miserably cold place in the Old West without, like, you know, electric heaters or electric anything. It's pretty amazing. I hope a lot of people see it. I think it's a really strong work.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited for The Thicket. I got Tubi. I'm gonna check it out.
Yep.
Maybe tonight. Maybe right after this.
Well, I think it might only be on VOD right now. But it's worth paying for.
I'll pay the money. But
I don't know if our listeners need to hear this inside baseball. I think you probably have a screener link. Anyway.
Damn it. You're probably right. I just probably have to go through my inbox. You know, it was pointed out today by, last week by Michael Dispenza. I only have like 148,000 unread emails in my inbox. It's, you know, a very small number.
Oh, so, man.
Anyway.
And now, Close Focus.
So Ben, we got to get into our Close Focus. What are we yakking about? What is going on with the world and the business of entertainment right now?
Well, I feel like some weeks it's kind of hard for us to find the exact right thing, but this week was not that kind of week because there was an announcement that Lionsgate had inked a deal with AI company Runway to reshape how studios greenlight movies. That's the IndieWire headline. And there's a lot of word salad associated with this, And hold on, I'm going to actually look up my least favorite one because it made me angry. So here's the quote. Runway is a visionary, best-in-class partner who will help us utilize AI to develop cutting-edge, capital-efficient content creation opportunities.
Yeah, so, that's a good one. I actually like the one that's a little bit further on, and that's the same article too, which says, we're committed to giving artists, creators, and studios the best and most powerful tools to augment their workflows and enable new ways of bringing their stories to life.
Yeah, and before anyone gets mad at me, I've been way into generative AI from the very beginning. I was using Midjourney 2 years ago. I am not afraid of AI, generative AI at all. I think it has its place. It's very useful for certain things. It does things nothing else can do. Cool. But the fact that they're kind of touting the fact that
It's cheap.
And by the way, Runway is like one of the leaders in video AI. Yeah. But that they're going to train it on Lionsgate's library. And to me, this is where I hear a record scratch, because did not every union go down fighting last year? Now, I'm a member of the Directors Guild, and the Directors Guild did not go on strike. Some might say rolled over and let the studios scratch them on the belly a little bit. But I never said that. Some might say that.
It's been said. It's official.
I'm a proud member of the DGA. I think that's great. But I did go and march with SAG, and I did go and march with the Writers Guild, mostly at CBS Radford. And it's because, one of the main things was they were afraid of AI being used to replace them. And there's very real fear for actors, and I think an even more real fear for writers about AI. Basically, it's not about AI being able to write a better script. It's about a cheap producer or a cheap production company who thinks that they can get around having a writer by having AI write the script, and then eventually the audience gets inured to crappier scripts.
It's really interesting timing, too, because this comes right on the heels of Gavin Newsom signing a law. Now, granted, maybe it's symbolic and less teeth in, you know, less teeth in this law, but essentially saying how in California, you weren't going to be able to get away with using AI, you know, representations of actors to replace them.
Yeah.
So it's...
So this is what I wonder about. Is it even okay under the current union agreements that are with SAG, the Directors Guild, and the Writers Guild? And again, the Writers Guild and the Actors Guild went on strike, and this was a big thing they went on strike for. You know, I don't know if John Wick has anything to do with it other than being released by Lionsgate, but every article I see about it has a still from John Wick. So let's use it as an example.
It's because John Wick is the largest, you know, I would say hit parade, largest, most recent hit coming out of Lionsgate. I also heard Hunger Games mentioned several times because Hunger Games was probably the biggest franchise, lately.
Could you take all of the John Wick movies and drop them into Runway ML and say to Runway ML, make me a John Wick style fight scene? And I'm sure that it would do a laughably weird one that would be full of hallucinations, and you would look at it and be like, ha ha ha, that's what a computer thinks a John Wick looking fight scene should look like. And But I don't understand it. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was like, no, they're talking about using AI in pre-production and post-production. And I'm like, okay, if you're using AI to build your schedule, firstly, you don't need Runway to do it. Secondly, that's not news. No, you're not going to put out a press report like, hey, we figured out how to use AI to make sure that our post schedules are more optimized. Who gives a fuck? This is all about stealing from artists, and it's super, super frustrating.
It's all about paying less money. It really is. It's about paying less money, making the production costs less so that some very large companies can be more profitable. And let's say they pull it off. Let's say they can have Runway or some other form of AI actually generate the project in such a way that they are able to reduce the number of artists, reduce the number of technicians, reduce the number of people. I don't think they should be rewarded for that. No. You're making a better product at the end of the day. In fact, Hollywood is notorious for having good enough, the attitude of good enough. Like, we could have done this better, but this was good enough to get it past most people. And I think that the mindset should be, how do we elevate? How do we do better? How do we make something that actually has an evokes emotional response?
No, I don't know, think Elliot, that AI people, currently but does the, that. What the audience wants is cutting-edge, capital-efficient content creation opportunities. Clearly.
Clearly, clearly they're not making movies for me.
They're making them so other AI can watch them. Wait till the AI film critics show up. That'll be really interesting. We were afraid of Skynet, but really we should have been afraid of robot Siskel and Ebert coming out and reviewing AI movies.
You jest, but I guarantee you there are some people right now trying to figure out how they can be AI critics, and they can have AI critic aggregation. And yes, it's going to be the AI watching the AI. And you know what happens when that happens? It all eventually leads to nothing. Here, you cannot train AI on AI right
now. I've said it before. I'll say it again. I believe this to my heart. Like when Terminator 2 came out, I remember I was into special effects makeup, and a friend of mine was like, well, I guess we're screwed. Like, all that stuff we learned about special effects makeup, it's all useless now. And it wasn't. I quit being a special effects makeup artist, but there are still thriving special effects makeup artists working. And I feel like this is another iteration of CGI. CGI is part of the process. We use CGI for certain things. We use practical for certain things. And I feel like there are going to be certain things AI will be able to tackle better than everything else. I think that it's going to become an irreplaceable part of certain workflows. Like, for instance, if you're a Photoshop user now and you're not using generative fill, you're missing out. It's pretty amazing. And it's using AI to look at your photograph and paint stuff out or put stuff in it. And it's usually using AI to say, what's the geometry of this? What's the distance? What's the lens that was used? And then it's filling stuff in, and it can do a pretty good job, and it'll inevitably take seconds to do what might have taken you 20 minutes. That's all cool, and maybe stuff you couldn't have done at all. I think AI is going to be in the workflow. AI is going to be there, but I don't know about any cutting edge, capital efficient content creation opportunities. You knew when they put that word content in there, they're just trolling me, right? Like, that was just like a fuck you to me.
You know, I'm reminded of the movie Elysium. I don't know. Did you see Elysium? You know the movie
I'm talking about? Yeah. Neil Blomkamp.
There's a scene in the beginning where Matt Damon has to go sit down with an AI and explain like a situation. And of course, the AI customer service like won't hear what I'm feeling more and more confident as AI progresses. Customer service is going to be one of the first things. Human customer service. Like, already I had to deal with the cable company today, and the cable company tried everything they possibly could to have me not talk to a human. Use our chatbot. Use our AI enhanced, app to, solve my problems. No, it took the scheduling from Comcast. Here, I'm going off on this far tangent, but I feel like it's all totally germane because of the influence and just rush to immediately make things worse at the promise of a lower cost is to me like, this is things we are doing to ourselves. Corporations are deciding to make things worse because it's AI. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if you are concerned about quality in anything, I don't think that rushing to AI right now actually makes your life better. I think it makes it worse.
I think for filmmaking too, it's like, it's inevitable, probably has already happened already. But someone's going to make a movie using AI. It's going to happen. And I'm pretty sure it's already happened.
But someone's going to make one that they're
going to try and push out to a mass audience, and it's going to suck. And it's going to put the cause of let's make movies using AI way back. I think if you're Industrial Light and Magic, and you realize that you can use AI to make better water sims than whatever program you're using, go for it. Who gives a shit? That's just innovation.
That's not what we're talking about, though. We're talking about, removing actual benefits, strong benefits from human interactive or human labor being removed from the process and things being made worse and someone going, good enough, move on.
Yeah.
I think that's the wrong way to look at it. No. And here I am, I'm a total Luddite wearing my, you know, archaic format, never forget. I'm totally the old man screaming about getting off my lawn. And it's like, I think a lot of like generative AI stuff is clever. Is it better? No. It's not better. It's clever. Not better.
No, so. It's fun. I say, and I can't stop waxing this man's car, go with Michael Cioni and Strada. Use AI to work smarter, not harder. That's what AI is best at. It's best at doing kind of the grunt work. That's what it should be doing. Anyway, we can complain about this crap all day long. I wish no ill will on Lionsgate. I hope that they have massive success. I don't predict that this is going to be one of them. But let's get on to our interview.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and congratulations on The Thicket. When is The Thicket coming out?
It is out. Yeah, it came out September the 6th. It was released by Samuel Goldwyn. We did a lovely art house platform release.
Mm-hmm.
Got a true theatrical window, which means it opens in theaters first before going to VOD.
I wish more movies would do that.
I mean, we were very lucky because of our partners Tubi, and then Peter and myself were pretty insistent that we get that. I mean, the way the movie looks, you know, it's anamorphic, it's 240, it's landscape heavy. We felt that it sort of deserved it, you know. I know it's becoming rarer and rarer.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were sort of grateful that we were able to do that, you know. We didn't want to just be a button on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever want to disparage Netflix, because in so many ways it props up the industry, and all of these streaming services have kind of become, you know, integral to the industry. But it's exactly what you're saying, where it's like it's too easy to lose awesome movies on a lot of these services, and I wish there was a way we could curate them better so that we could find the stuff better.
I will say, not to be too much of an advert for Tubi, their philosophy is no audience too small, and their collection is so well archived. I mean, you can find Belmondo up there, you can find obscure Paul Schrader movies, as well as, you know, the usual other sort of stuff. I really am sort of impressed. They're almost like a Criterion collection in many ways.
They are pretty amazing. They're like the third biggest streaming service too. They're like ahead of everybody except for Netflix.
And they're just
Netflix.
Growing. They're just growing. They're really user-friendly. I had a really good time working with them theatrically. You know, our partner Adam Lewinson it's just been tremendous.
So Tubi was part of the theatrical?
Yeah, Tubi basically paid for the film.
Mm. Oh, wow.
They had seen the package back at Berlin Film Festival in 2020, and they fell in love with it. But then COVID happened and everything went on hiatus.
For real.
I mean, the world just shut down. I think Peter just did Cyrano in between. But yeah, we shut down. But to their credit, never gave up on the film. They were as passionate about it in 2023 as they were in 2019.
That's awesome. I hope they come out with like a paid version of Tubi without the ads, because to me that's the only hiccup, and it's not even really that much of a hiccup. But you know, like a movie like yours, I would like, you know, I'm glad that I got to just watch the whole thing in one go, you know, without it being broken up at all. So tell me, what is the pitch of The Thicket? Tell our listeners like what.
I mean, it's effectively a road movie. I would sum it up as like, it's a little bit like The Searchers. It's a contemporary version.
Yeah. I kept thinking about that.
Brother and a sister who are separated. You know, one is kidnapped by a terrible villain, Cutthroat Bill, played beautifully by Juliette Lewis. And, you know, the young man played again incredibly well by Levon Hawke, Ethan Hawke's kid, has to decide that he's got to pursue his sister. So he enlists two grave diggers.
Mm-hmm. Like you do.
Peter Dinklage and Gebenga Akinaba. And off they go on this road movie. It's very, very linear. But more than that, what I wanted to do is an in-depth character study, because the format is well known. But the characterization is not.
Mm-hmm.
that I've sort of done like a sort of character sort of chamber piece set in the American West.
That totally tracks. And it as a Western, you know, like, you know, there are so many different styles of Westerns. This movie, I kind of want to hear how you went about finding the style for it, because it feels, I have no idea what it was like in the Old West, but it feels like what it must have really been like as compared to, you know, Westerns that are kind of romanticized or even spaghetti Westerns or whatever. This kind of feels like you feel like everyone in this movie is fighting for survival, and it feels very real and grounded.
And they were on set, and that is by no means a joke. I mean, we were in minus 35 degrees.
Ooh.
Taking it back to your original question. So I, you know, as a director, I've had my head filled with many, many, many movies, many, many influences. But typically what I've been doing of late is I look more at photography and art to sort of inform the feeling. Because the moment you shoot that very first frame, you're dictating how that movie's going to be. You can't go back once you've shown it. You know, the aesthetic was an aesthetic choice based on the location. You know, it becomes undeniable. Where you put the camera becomes the language, and how you put the camera becomes the other language and informs how the performance is going to feel. I wanted to be very sort of either very, very back, where the audience was always looking up, you know, feeling that environment and feeling the brutality of it, and couple that with the idea that, you know, there was something always intriguing to look at in the frame. There are no dead frames, you know, and the camera is, I mean, if you were going to give it a sort of a comp, you'd probably say it was like McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You'd say something like The Revenant. That would be sort of a feeling, but I never really did a deep dive onto those films. I try to make a film be a thing in itself, and it's really important. And I mean, when I was a younger filmmaker, you know, certainly when I was doing music videos, I'd pull out all the coffee table books and find everything. It'd be a mishmash of bad ideas. But as you sort of go through your journey as a director, when you start off being crap, and then you get in your sixth movie, or hopefully you have, then you sort of go, okay, well, this is the world that I want to live in, and this is what I want to convey. We got very lucky with that location. There's no doubt about that.
It was shot in Canada, right?
Shot in Alberta, Canada, in the middle of winter.
Oof.
I mean, oof ain't the fucking truth.
I know, it's like mostly exteriors. There's so many exteriors.
I think there's maybe three interiors.
Okay, so I know we said we weren't going to get into technical stuff, but how do you keep the crew alive in that kind of weather?
Well, like the crew are mountain goats. I mean, these guys live in Calgary.
Yeah.
And they're used to it. I mean, they're acclimated. For me, living in sunny South California, I had a technique where I would come out and just get my core temperature down, and then I'd load up with the Canada Goose and layer and layer and layer, you know, which was easier for me than it was for the cast, because they did not have that luxury.
Yeah, they got to wear a wardrobe. They got to look like, yeah, I mean, they're not covered up, but they're not especially covered up.
I mean, they're not. And on one occasion, we thought one of the actors was going to get frostbite. Esme Creed Miles, who played Lula, we had a problem, and we had to de-ice her. She had I mean, it got so cold one day that we shut the movie down, because once you get minus 35, you know, as a base is not comfortable. But then with a wind chill, it got to minus 75, and our line producer came.
Oh my God.
We gotta go. So we shut down.
Oof. I mean, like, I'm just surprised that...
Ask me about the lenses. No.
Well, oh, we're totally gonna... That was my next question, was, like, cameras. Like, was the gear turning off because it was too cold?
One, typically you have, like, the camera truck heated. Day one, someone had not turned on the heating in the camera truck.
Oops.
And our follow focus went down and lenses were freezing. So we had to be very careful not to sort of like, because obviously the glass gets too cold, it'll break. But we were,
when you say they were freezing, like would they not turn? Would the elements not spin?
The follow focus wouldn't work. I mean, it would just drift because it was messed up. But you know, the crews were used to it. You know, we weren't, so we were playing, you know, we were learning as we went. We did something also called French hours, which means you had continuous days. So it allowed us to sort of work all the way through, no breaking for lunch, let's just get through the days. But it was sort of a remarkable, there's a very sort of interesting spirit up there. Yeah, we suffered through it. You know, you cannot get comfortable. You can't get comfortable, which I think actually helps the performances.
Yeah, well, you can't be thinking about anything else. Like, yeah, I mean, it's probably taking all their energy to just remember their lines because it's... But I mean, like, these performances are really amazing performances. And, you know, you brought up Juliette Lewis. Like, I've never seen Juliette Lewis do anything like that. Like, that was
I don't
crazy.
Think Juliette Lewis has seen herself do anything like that. And she speaks about it. She's spoken about it very openly about how she thinks it's one of her strongest performances because she completely disappears.
She does. I mean, when I got the screener, I didn't look to see who was in it. I knew Peter Dinklage was in it, but I didn't look. And I was like, that person looks familiar. Who's that? You know, and her name's Bill. And I'm like, oh, and then like at a certain point it hit me who it was. It was just like, that's just crazy.
Well, I think part of it went a little bit crazy on the film. I mean, I think she sort of decided she made choices, you know, she wanted to go deep and dark. And most days I wasn't dealing with Juliet, you know, I was dealing with Cutthroat Bill. And it was, you know, at times she was formidable, but that doesn't make it easy when you're dealing with that level of darkness. And you've got to imagine what the actor's going through.
Yeah.
I mean, also she's sitting there and that breath that she's breathing that you see is real. There's no VFX on that. You know, like most of the time you'll put the breath on or whatever. We did not do that.
It didn't look like it. I mean, that's the thing about it. And I, you know, probably one of my main questions while watching it was like, I mean, and I think you've already answered it, but it's like how finding a naturalistic look like you have. Is just as hard as any other look, but it doesn't feel lit with a capital L. It feels very, very natural. So yeah,
it's not. There's no light.
Really?
We didn't have the luxury of lighting. We had light that we knew wouldn't get above 10 or 11 o'clock during the day. So you always had low winter sun. So everything was very, very soft. And then you had something called the Chinooks. And the Chinooks are these winds that come in and they blow everything away. And then once the Chinook comes, the weather gets even colder.
Oh, God.
So we knew that we had the efficiency of a beautiful location, which in some ways made our job. I don't think we would have got through that schedule had we had to light a bunch of stuff.
So, I mean, like when you say, I mean, like, were there some lights? I mean, you know, there are nighttime exteriors and stuff like that. Like, I mean, you know, I've watched like 12K lights get blown over by wind before. So like, I can imagine how awful.
We had BB night lights occasionally. Mm. Certainly on the interiors, we used real sort of Edison filaments because I wanted to create that sort of sense of like,
oh, wow.
Change, and in Change you had the automation came in, hence the motorbike, and then the actual lighting. I wanted to sort of create that very sort of low sort of amberish feel.
And you got the actual Edison filaments? Like you got actual...
We did get Edison filaments. I mean, we got our version of Edison filaments.
Obviously,
and then the DP, I can't take anything away from the DP, Guillermo Garza, who did a phenomenal job. One of the reasons I hired him or collaborated with him, I should say, was because he just had an amazing understanding of naturalism. You know, he's a pretty remarkable DP. And the way we prepped is we got the script, he would come to the office and I would act out the scenes. And I've played every part. really, really badly. He would go around and we would configure sort of how we wanted to shoot. It doesn't necessarily mean you end up doing it, but yeah, there's an ideal, which speaks to the earlier thing about creating a look. And when we came to set, I don't think he and I spoke at all, actually. Because I said to him, I said, listen, I need to be there for the actors, okay? You and I have built our language. Do that, I'll give you the blocking, and then you know what to do. And then we were very much in sync, you know?
So when you were doing those rehearsals with him, were you creating a shot list? Were you creating storyboards? Were you taking?
We were trying to do a because we had so little prep time. We would create a version of a shot list, which was sort of very aspirational. I think I did more storyboarding on this movie than I've done on any of the others, actually. I found it useful, to be honest. I found it quite useful, but what I really found useful was really knowing that I couldn't act. So I was like, you know, they say all directors want to be actors. No, I don't think that's going to happen.
I mean, you were talking about how, you know, the sun was low in the sky, would you call it the noonday sun or something? But like, that was one thing that I kept noticing as kind of a style reference, is the sun was probably in more shots of this than any movie I could think of outside of Terrence Malick or something. Like, I felt like even in like the every still that I've pulled up on it, there's usually the sun kind of right behind someone giving us bloom or halation. I never know the difference, but that kind of presence outside, kind of light wrap kind of a thing. And some of that feels like it's because you're in like a really overcast place in the sun, so the sun, you're able to point the camera right at the sun. But was that something that you thought about at all? Did you schedule for, we want to be here when the
we
sun
try.
Is here?
Yeah, I mean, that's typically what you do anyway. You build out your days. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had to go, you do things in blocks, right? You're in one location for this amount of time, and then what you do is you build out within that time to obviously match where you're shooting on that particular day. You know, when we would, because we didn't want to move too many times, because every time you move, you're sort of losing time. But then, yes, we would go in and we would, I used to be a first assistant director. That's how I got my start.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
I know, it's quite unusual.
I don't know that we've ever, I mean, we probably have, we usually talk to DPs anyway, but I don't know that I've spoken to a director who started as an AD. Like the director's guild is kind of walled off, where it's like there's the AD wing and the director wing and the UPM wing.
I had a really fortuitous entree to becoming an AD. I was 22 and my friend was Tony Kaye's assistant, who was the director of American History X. Tony was a real maverick, and I don't think he had too much respect for crew. I think he was quite an unconventional guy. Anyway, one day he goes, I'm going to pick you as my AD. And he picked me to be his first AD to do all the reshoots and pickups, you know, on this very large, very difficult, very tense movie.
Well, and from what I've heard of the legends, that's not an insignificant number of pickups. Like, it was like,
no, I think he did. I think he spent $1 million, $2 million of his own money in doing them. And, you know, I must say I admired his passion. I don't think I admired his methodology. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very unhappy place to be. You know? And being 22, you know, having to, my first day shooting with him, we were shooting in a prison. You know, and I had 100 extras, I had 4 cameras going, and I was dealing with this man who was very, very frustrated. I mean, the first minute of the day, he throws the craft service table over.
What?
The opener for the day, you know, and then he goes into one of the jail cells and he's like sort of like swaying and baying like a goat. And the producer doesn't want to deal with him. And she says, look, you've got to, let's get him out. And I go in and I'm talking to him very sympathetically. Okay, Tony, we've got to shoot. We've got 150 people up there. And he looked at me quite kindly and was like, okay. And realized we had to go up and shoot. I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot about being driven. I don't think I learned a lot about how to handle actors. I think it's sort of well documented that it was a very, very challenging shoot between him and Ed Norton. I definitely saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like, if you want to get your best out of your actor, then don't do a close up of their ear when you're doing their monologue.
So, oh man.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. But then, you know, 22, 23, I was able to sort of start being a first AD very young.
Was that a DGA project? Did you have to join the guild?
Didn't join the guild.
It's hard to believe that American History X wasn't DGA.
It was DGA, but the reshoots and the pickups were not.
Oh.
I was able to sort of like slip and slide. That was Tony. It was super unconventional, you know. And then, you know, I was able to dine out on those stories. Everybody wanted a story. They all wanted the story. And then from there, I went with Vincent Gallo on a very strange film called Hollywood Salome. And
I've seen Buffalo 66 and The Brown Bunny. I've never even heard of Hollywood Salome.
He kind of got shelved, which is not unlike a couple of his other films.
Mm-hmm.
A lot about Vincent Gallo, one of which being, don't bring him to set in the morning unless he's finished his Fruity Pebbles. You know, he had a rule.
Fruity don't Pebbles.
Fruity Pebbles, the cereal.
Wow.
Gotta finish my Fruity Pebbles.
That's not a euphemism for something.
I sort of like realized that films were good, but I could make more of a living doing music videos. And I became the sort of rap, hip hop, R&B.
But you were directing those. You weren't ADing this.
No, these ones I was not. I was an AD.
Oh, okay.
23, 24, doing these massive jobs. And really, you know, like I said, I worked with, you know, one of your previous guests, Maddie Libertique. We did like Master P videos. We were just...
He's the best. I love Maddie so much.
I mean, you know, and everybody had to get their start and I had to get my start as an AD. And eventually what happened, the last job I wanted to do as an AD, I was 27 years old. So I'd gone from 22-ish to 27.
Mm.
I maxed out at being an AD and I was on a Foo Fighters video for times like these. And, you know, we're dropping stuff off bridges. And then I sort of stood there and I looked at my director and then I thought, I think I want something more than yelling action and cut for somebody else. Mm. And I think I can give this a go. So I dived in feet first. I mean, you're never good at the beginning. And I had a friend called Santi Gold, who was a singer.
Oh, yeah.
And I made her crappiest video. I decided to embarrass myself. But I didn't really care. He was 27 years old. You've got to remember, I'd been doing work. I'd done every possible setup. And I say setup, meaning hundreds of extras, VFX, stunts. I'd done all of this work. But until you're in the sort of driving seat and you're the director, it's meaningless. You know, you're a glory boy. So the moment I stepped into the seat of a director, I realized, oh, I've got a lot to learn.
There's a lot. So did you go to film school or like?
I did not. I have a philosophy degree. I didn't go to film school. I mean, I tinkered around, maybe made a music video here and there, you know, just like for mates, but as you would. But no, I had no formal training. It was.
So how did you end up in the orbit of Tony K to end up on American History X? If you were.
I wanted to be in the film business.
Mm.
And I started off doing Japanese commercials as a production assistant and then sort of got hooked on the life because it's highly addictive when you're young. You know, there's trucks and the unit and you're being well fed and it's just cameras and it's frothy and atmospheric and you're wearing the gear. You sort of fall in love with the lifestyle and then you realize you fall in love with the medium, you know, and ultimately... That's what I did.
That's so interesting. So you were part of, you know, like, and we were talking about before we hit record, but you were part of what I would consider to be kind of like the last wave of music videos as like a mover of culture. You know, music videos are still made today. You know, there are channels on YouTube like Vivo that play them. I don't think MTV plays them at all. But like there was a time where I feel like a young director like yourself was able to cut your teeth in the music video world and move on to commercials, move on to movies, move on to a lot of things. And I'm not saying that ship has totally sailed, because there are still people doing it, but it's a much different world now. What was it like? Because it felt like...
What was it like?
Yeah.
It was exactly like if it looked.
Really?
It was incredible. I mean, it was, you know, you had three channels at the time, you know, MTV, VH1, BET.
Yeah.
And you had TRL, Total Request Live, which was like, everybody tuned in for it.
Carson Daly, yeah.
Everybody watched, and you had a chart, you know. And yeah, we didn't have, you know, our cell phones with a billion hours of stuff to watch. Not that that's a problem, because I think that's opened up the world in a different way.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. I was doing, you know, incredible music videos. I was working with Jay-Z, Method Man, and Redman. I was working with Missy Elliott. I was working with Bubba Sparks. I was working with Nelly. And I was working in this arena where, you know, these guys were rock stars. They were living a rock star life. And I, you know, was standing on the 1 yard line, really enjoying them, enjoying themselves. I mean, there was, you know, look, it's very hard, you know, going 22 hours on a music video and the artist is 8 hours late and they won't come out of their trailer until they've had a certain meal or a certain thing, you know, and I embraced it. I loved it. I would do things where I would finish one video at 2 a.m. in the morning, and at 6 a.m. in the morning, I'd be right onto another one, or I'd be jumping on a plane from St. Louis, where I finished Nelly, to go down to do a job in Florida for Trick Daddy, and then go north to New York and work with M.O.P. or Puffy. And, you know, I felt like I was living in their jet stream. Everything about it was glamorous, and not one moment of that felt false until the end. It just you felt that you were, just to echo what you were saying, you felt that you were in that moment. And I remember when it died.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
I'll tell you exactly when it ended. So Jay-Z did this video called Big Pimpin', where they rented a yacht, huge yacht, and they filled it full of girls and guys and spent I think $300,000 just on liquor. And they took the boat out, and it was just absurd. The video must have cost $2-3 million. And I said to Jay-Z, I said, tell me about making that video. And he was just like, it's over. I said, what do you mean? He goes, we can't recoup. And when the videos become more expensive than the money you can make, then it's pointless. That's when it ended. That's when, you know, this is a business and this makes no sense anymore. And I remember, because the budgets went from millions of dollars to like $200,000, which still sounds like a lot of money. But, you know, if you think about that, it's a huge relative to take a drop. But we lived an amazing life, you know, and a lot of the videos I would do, the artists were living their lives on the video. So the girls, the booze, the cars, the weed, it was all there. I don't think you could get away with it in the same way now, because everybody has a phone out and they, you know, would be snitching on each other. But, you know, it wasn't uncommon for whatever you thought in your head was going to happen. It happened.
Well, and as a director, how did that affect you though? Like you're there trying to kind of rally the chaos.
I think for me, I just leaned into it. But these were all sort of like, this was a typical day. there was no sort of like, oh, that happened. That's nothing. You know, it was like, okay, this is going on. That, listen, I was shooting in Memphis, and you know, there was some gang activity and bang, 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 bang. You know, there'd be a guns would go off and you would stand there. And because it was happening so quickly, you would just stare and then you just get back straight back to work. There was nothing. God. There was no scenario that was that we didn't live out. I mean, maybe my easiest job was working with Celine Dion. You know, that was sort of like a vacation. You know, she would show up, you'd shoot for 2 hours, and then she'd leave. You know, that was pleasant.
So, what is your journey in the music video world from Santigold? From you saying, from your own admission,
I mean, Santigold. You know, I did like Keith Murray. I did, you know, Method.
But like you did the Santigold video, and you said it, you weren't happy with it.
No, I couldn't be happy with it. It would be impossible. You can't shoot your first film unless you. Orson Welles with Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
You go, oh my goodness, this is epic. No, it was shit. But it was my shit. I realized that. It was my shit. It was my point of view. And I owned that. And then what happened was I started getting born again Christian videos, which was a big market. And then I got a call one day. Elliot, we need you to come and do a Jessica Simpson video. And I was like, and we need you, because there was always an urgency about work. And I got a call. I went to see Jessica Simpson at her house. And they were like, okay, we're going to do, she had the Newlywed Show. So I had to do a music video for that, where she's eating chicken wing, chicken at the sea and on the Swift. And we did it. And the thing just blew up. It just absolutely went through the roof. And I got like a music video nomination. And then it was off. And I did a band called The Fray. Mm. And then Jared Leto got hold of me. And we sort of co-directed. And he said, we're going to go to China. I said, cool. He said, we're going to go to China for like 6 weeks, though. And I, okay. So we jumped on a plane. And we drove from Shanghai north to this sort of purpose-built studio where they had replicas of the Forbidden Palace and I Ching and all these amazing things. And we shot this music video for a song called From Yesterday, and it was epic. It was Bertolucci. We had hundreds of warriors on horses. We had Chinese fighters, we had sing song,
wow.
And you know, and we had days and days and shot for days, and that video became a kind of a hit again. It was just sort of like, in recalling it, it was just an incredible time. You know, you were living in this amazing sort of state where the possibilities were endless. And remember, these were short jobs in a relative to a film. And then, you know, I got the opportunity to do my first feature film, Love is a Drug. And I just embraced it. I ran at it.
Had you been aiming at doing features the whole time? You know, it sounds like you started as an AD in features, but then like this music video thing sounds intoxicating.
Everything with me was a loose plan that sort of fell into place. I was obsessive about directing, totally obsessive. And once I got my teeth into something, it was like a dog with a bone. And I would tell myself, all I want to do is make a movie. And once I make a movie, then I've done that. And then obviously not being sort of trained in anything other than crew and then obviously music videos. My first film was I got lucky with it because I knew what I didn't know and I knew what I did know. Mm-hmm. And what I did know was how to get a day's work together, because what you have to do on a low budget film, I had like $600,000, you know, and a really good cast. I had Lizzie Kaplan, Daryl Hannah, John Patrick Amador. I had a really wonderful cast. And then
it was a big hit at Slam Dance, right?
Huge hit.
Yeah.
I was amazed by, you know, it became this spectacle. It was, you know, it was quite remarkable. But you know, doing a feature film, it was another sort of area to learn, because you don't know when you first start shooting a movie, at least. There's so much to consider. You know, it's not just, you're not just helming the scene and the photography and the acting. You're also very aware of a schedule and a budget. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the same problems I have on a small film I had on the biggest films I've done. That's just, as I said earlier. And then I just got the bug, Ben. I just got the bug. But Maddie had gone off and done Requiem for a Dream. And I remember calling him up, and I'd never seen anything quite like it. And I took him for a curry. And I sat down and I was like, you've got to tell me how, because it was so remarkable. And I was like, well, maybe I can aspire to something like that. And we were in an era of like Paul Thomas Anderson, you know.
Yeah, you're kind of at the tail end of sort of the independent film movement that started in the late 80s and, you know, kind of petered out around 2010
it
or
was,
so.
It was sort of glorious because you were sort of like Tarantino was sort of emerging. You know, there were real voices. But at least they were, I'd say they were real voices. They were our voices, because I think each generation has their own voice.
Of course. Like
now it's Safdie Brothers or whoever. But,
well, I do look at that time, and I'm not, I mean, there's always independent film, and there's always those voices that are kind of coming up. But I do feel like at that time you would have Tarantino, Richard Linklater, Kevin Smith, Darren Aronofsky, these people kind of coming out of that world and kind of staying in this, like, let's tell interesting stories in our own voice, Paul Thomas Anderson, like you said. And I feel like it's not the fault of the filmmakers, but I feel like the way the industry eventually went was like, oh, you made a cool film that was a big hit at Sundance, let's get you a Spider-Man movie. And I feel like there's been kind of this rush to take people who are good at telling a character-driven story or an interesting story and blowing it up to no disrespect whatsoever to superhero movies, but like a giant studio monster thing or a Jurassic Park.
And then they fail. You can't go from dealing with your 21 day indie that you shoot, you know, in a basement to.
I don't besmirch anyone who takes that opportunity, and sometimes people make the most of it. But I feel like culturally, what we lose is kind of what you've made in the thicket, and what I see a lot when I see a movie like Strange Darling, which, you know, we had Giovanni Ribisi on recently, who was the DP on that.
Yeah, he's a cameraman. I worked with him.
He's amazing. Did you work with him as a cameraman?
I did a music video for John Spencer Blues Explosion with Gio, Winona Ryder.
Oh wow.
And John C. Reilly. And he's a lovely guy, super talented.
Crazy.
I heard he was a DP on
that. So he shot Strange Darling. But like when I see a movie like that, when I see a movie like The Thicket, it brings me back to like, oh yeah, these movies don't have to be IP. They don't have to be connected to a interconnected universe of other stuff. They could just be a really great story in and of themselves. And even though like The Thicket is playing with genre in that it is a Western, it's not like any Western. I couldn't connect it one-to-one to any Western I've ever seen before. I mean,
done my job.
Yeah.
Then I've done my job, because here's the thing, what film is supposed to do is you challenge you a little bit. You know, look, it's genre. You can't deny it's genre. But what I feel I attempted to do was, if you take genre and you pivot it slightly and you contemporize it, like I did with the cast, you know, with Peter and Juliet, Leslie Grace. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but those characters feel like they've sort of stepped out of time a little bit. And what it does, it allows the viewer to look at something in a different way. I've certainly, you know, the comments about the film have been, you know, really kind. But that's what I set out to do. You know, I'm not saying I've done that with every film. You can't always do that. But like, I had the ambition for the film.
I know that you said that you didn't talk extensively on set with Guillermo Garza. But let's talk a little bit about your relationship and like what brought you to work with him on the film.
Well, he'd actually been recommended to me, ironically, by the man that produced Pi and Requiem for a Dream, Darren Aronofsky's original producer, Eric Watson, who produced Aftermath with Darren for me. And Eric had great taste. And he said to me, you should meet this guy, you know. And I took a recommend and I went and I met him and I gave him the script and I met him again. And he sort of showed me his feelings towards the film. And then it sort of becomes emotional, you know. You're sort of like, is this guy going to be able to shoot me in a soulful film? You know, you can be technical, you know, like guys like Claudia Miranda, who are brilliant, brilliant technicians, but can you give me something that's soulful and tactile? And yeah, I found that. And Eric, you know, is a dear friend and has great taste. So I wanted to listen to him. You have to listen to your peers. You know, that's the whole point. It is, for want of a better word, even though as a director, you're a little bit like a boxer, there's still an amazing community of people to talk to. And you know, I try and dive into that.
And when you say could shoot soulfully, like what does that mean to you in a film like this? Like how does I hate to deconstruct it, but like how does that become a choice of lenses? And
it also could be, you could consider it as being completely pretentious, which is fine as well. I mean, you know, there's a lyricism to framing, mm-hmm. right? There's a way you hold back on a frame. There's a way where you position the camera, you know, to sort of where it feels a little bit more heartfelt and not mannered so much. Like when you're shooting something like Transformers, you know, the camera is not necessarily giving you an emotional center. Whereas with, you know, I like to think Bob Elswit, who shoots for, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, mm-hmm. and when he shot, you know, There Will Be Blood, you were very much in the sort of center of the poetry. So what Guillermo was able to do was bring his sort of, you know, his wisdom to that. He knew how to, I knew in speaking to him, there was a level of sensitivity that would translate. And I already looked at his work, you know, and I think it translates.
Definitely, definitely. I'm just interested in like when you're kind of putting together, because this has such a specific look, when you're kind of, what are the pieces to you as a director? And I'm guessing, having done God knows hundreds of music videos that you've done, like your brain must be able, like you're accessing all of the different technical approaches and spontaneous approaches and all that kind of stuff.
That's a really interesting thing. You actually try to unlearn it, you know, because when I made music videos, you know, Jessica Simpson, The Fray, you know, Hilary Duff, Selena Gomez, you are coming at it from pretty much just an aesthetic point of view. You're not coming from a character point of view. So I actually try to unlearn it in many ways, because, you know, you sort of have a reflex, right? You have a reflex for how you're going to approach a job. So I spent a long time trying to roll that back.
What do you think about, like, Tarantino has kind of a famous quote about when he's on set, he stands next to the camera, but he watches the actors. He doesn't want to be at a remove at a monitor. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, the action's happening in front of in the frame, and the frame is in something that you can hold up and look at. I mean, yes, it's great to watch the performance, and it's great to trust your operators, but I want to see what's going on in my 2-3-5 frame. I want to look at it and check it. I can always dive into the actor afterwards. But this is what's wonderful about it. Every director is different. Christopher Nolan has an approach where no monitors on set. He has his monitor, his handheld monitor, and he's the only one that's looking at the vision. You know, other people have a monitor everywhere and they want everybody's opinion. Yeah. You know, I am not of that persuasion. I don't love to have people around me, you know, but I do like to engage with the frame, because then I know what I'm dealing with. I know where the movement is.
No, it's very pragmatic.
If you're seeing, if the eye line is off, I mean, I can't fault Tarantino. It's a huge career and he's guessed right most of the time, but I have to guess my way.
Well, I guess I was bringing that up as just a question about, like, how would you typify your approach to working with actors? Like, what's the...
Well, I love actors. I love actors, and I love actors for every aspect of them. I love them for their ability to emotionally interpret work. I love them for their eccentricities. I don't mind it. You know, I tend to prep with the actor early on. We discuss so that when we get to set, the work is done. I don't overnote. You know, a lot of directors will come in and go, okay, when you just did that bit in the middle of the take, do me a favor. Would you come up on the inflection? I will just be deeper, slower, faster, because if you've cast right, which is the job, then you don't need to sort of second guess and overnote. Let them be, let them out of space. They'll trust you more if you do that.
That's awesome, especially when you're working with actors like this. Although I'm interested in how you went about creating, I mean, everybody's performance is great, but I do feel like Cutthroat Bill is such an iconic character. And did how much work did you do with Juliette Lewis to kind of find
tons.
That?
Tons. I would send her music. We talked about David Bowie. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about her father, you know, Richard Lewis, who was a very famous character actor who was in High Plains Drifter. He played the villain.
Yeah.
And you know how she wanted to make that character. She said to me, I don't want to let my father down. You know, because he was, he played the villain in High Plains Drifter. That was important to her. I mean, there was constant dialogue. There was, you know, as we were getting into it, there was anxiety as well. I recognized that because I think Juliet wanted to get to the core of the truth of the character. Now, that's not an easy character to live with in your head.
Yeah.
Someone who kills children, who's been thrown on a fire and had a throat slashed. You know, so I try to be there for them as much as I can. I used to do things where every night, because in Calgary, everyone's a hunter. Mm. And, you know, they would show up with moose meat and elk meat and all this stuff. And what I would do, because my wife, Brooke, was with me as a producer, we would throw these meals every night. We were freezing during the day and then we would cook a meal and we'd cook up this meat and everyone would come over and we would bond. You know, and then we go back to work the following day and freeze our balls off.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. I can't recommend the movie highly enough. I think it's really engaging and beautiful, and I feel like all this everything you're saying really comes across. So I hope a lot of people go out and see it.
Ben, thank you so much for your time. I do love your podcast, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I really like it. And you'd always have such interest. We're not recording now, right?
Oh, we are still recording.
you really have great guests.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You really have great. And you cover so many ranges and really. Yeah.
We've been at it for 10 years.
I couldn't believe it. Really steer the interview. And I, you know, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Before we go, is there any place people can interact with you or find you online?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Elliot Lester 88. Two L's, two T's in Elliot, L-E-S-T-E-R. That's probably the only place. I do respond to people. Like, you know, people send me short films and
cool.
They want a bit of advice. I'm very happy to give it. You know, it's a part of the being able to give back a little bit. So I'm happy to talk to anybody who wants.
Well, that's awesome, Elliot. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And
bye, Ben.
So that was Elliot Lester. Elliot, thank you so much for being on the show. I can't wait to go and watch The Thicket.
Everybody go watch The Thicket. Please check it out on VOD if you get a chance. And if not, it will be on Tubi soon enough. But I like some Tubi. I like it a lot. I wish Tubi would add a premium subscription so I could watch it without commercials.
And now, Short Ends.
Indeed. So Ben, it is our famed Short End time of the show. It's where we talk about our pet obsession of the week. What is it that you are obsessed about? What do you got going on?
Well, my Short End will surprise nobody.
Is it a horror movie?
It is a horror movie. And it came out this week, or it came out last week. It's called The Substance, starring Demi Moore.
Oh, yeah.
And it is really something. Holy crap. I hope I'm not butchering her name, Coryell Fargate, who she directed a really kick-ass, hyper-violent movie called Revenge that came out on Shudder a couple years ago and is quite a thing as well. But the leap here would be the same director directed a movie called Raw, and then another movie called Titane. And Raw is like a weird little cannibal yarn, and Titane is about someone who has a child with a car. full on body horror. True story.
Wow.
Okay, so Revenge is sort of like this is reducing it, but it's sort of like a feminist I spit on your grave, where some jerky dudes do a woman wrong and then she murders them all. It's pretty cool. I wouldn't compare anything I like to I Spit on Your Grave, because I don't like that movie at all. But Revenge, and it looks like chef's kiss, gorgeous.
So well, it's Benjamin Crossoon, who of course I interviewed for Promising Young Woman.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yeah. And Promising Young Woman also kind of a feminist horror movie in a way, and so The Substance was kind of a buzzy movie at Cannes. With Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley and Dennis Quaid in possibly his most odious role ever. He is such a creep. And I've seen it now twice. So our mutual friend Janelle invited me to a press screening, and I loved it so much that I dragged my wife to see it. It wasn't much of a drag because she wanted to see it anyway. what an assault on the senses. It is a movie. So Benjamin, how do you pronounce his last name? Sorry.
It's Crashoon. I think I'm saying it wrong. Maybe it's Crashoon. It's basically something like that. Right. I'll do my best.
So Benjamin Crashoon, the cinematography, like, this is a movie that knows how to use a big screen. It is worth seeing in the theaters. It also knows how to use the surround sound in a movie theater. Will it be fun to watch on home video? Sure. It'll be fun to watch streaming it. Great. Cool. But it is so worth seeing in an audience, just to see the reactions of people when this movie gets really going crazy. Because, right, like, you get about halfway through this movie, and when I was there, and you know me, Ilya, I've seen it all, and I'm like, I've never seen anything like this. This is like
good. It surprised you.
This is like David Cronenberg and David Lynch decided to drop a bunch of acid together. And
it's still coherent.
And it is totally coherent. Demi Moore is wonderful. Margaret Qualley is amazing. It is super gross. If you don't like gross stuff, you should skip it. I kind of don't want to spoil it for anyone, but I was kind of comparing it a little. So the basic premise of the movie is that Demi Moore is kind of an aging star in an imaginary world where the number one show on television is a morning exercise show, like an aerobics show that she's the host of. And she's basically been given her walking papers. And around that time, somebody slips her a thumb drive that just says The Substance with a note around it that says, "It changed my life." And basically, the idea is you inject yourself with this and a younger you comes out of yourself. And you have to
feed... Are you giving it away right now?
No. This is the premise.
Okay.
This doesn't even begin to describe how fucked up this movie is. And you have to switch bodies once a week, basically. You're only you, but it's all you. So Margaret Qualley is kind of birthed out of Demi Moore, and it ain't pretty. And I mean, she's pretty, and it's very Kubrick inspired. There's Kubrick fingerprints all over this movie. Wow. And I would describe it as, it's almost like you went into room 237 without Jack Torrance, but you just had the beautiful young woman and the hag. And I'm not saying Demi Moore is the hag. The hag comes later, believe me. And you're just kind of stuck in a room with the two of them. It looks great. The cinematography is phenomenal. It regularly cuts from like super wide shots to crazy macro close-ups. The sound design is electric. Like, I defy you to go see this movie and not feel something. It's so awesome. Could I have cut 10 minutes out of it? Maybe. But I loved it. I would see it a third time. I thought it was just amazing and beautiful and so messed up.
Friend of the show, guest of the show, Daniel Stilling, saw it, and he sent me a text message saying how much he loved it and loved the cinematography on it, and said he would love to hear you know, the DP come on the show and Benjamin come in and talk about the show. So I've put Alana on it, so maybe Ben, you will get your
Daniel reached out to me as well, and he's like, you got to see this, and I'm like, I already saw it twice.
Nice. I'm glad that Daniel's out there looking out for us, like, you know, trying to make sure that we're on top of basics.
Yeah, all right, so Ilya, what is your obsession of this week?
All right.
Oh boy.
it's something that has that's been out in the zeitgeist. I think it had its first premiere, I want to say Sundance, January this year, and it's called Thelma. Are you familiar with Thelma?
No, but I have to watch it. It's on my list.
You should see it. 100%.
I mean, I'm familiar with it. I just haven't seen it yet.
Okay, so Thelma is a caper. It's a story about a grandmother getting ripped off by telephone scammers, which is absolutely a real thing. It's becoming even more of a thing in this country these days. So Thelma, played by June Squibb, falls victim, pays a bunch of money to these people through the mail. Turns out, of course, it's all a scam. And the whole movie is her quest to get her money back from the scammers.
This is kind of the plot line of The Beekeeper, isn't it? Add Jason Statham and some more explosions, and it's the same basic idea.
You know, I think there's a bunch of, you know, sort of movies about people being wronged, being cheated, and then them getting revenge. This movie is charming and delightful. And just as you defied people to not be moved by the substance, I defy people in an entirely different way not to be moved by Thelma, especially if you had a good relationship with a grandparent, or maybe not even a grandparent, but like, maybe like an uncle or someone else who was, you know, not your immediate, you know, the person who gave birth to you, but like an older figure in your life. It's written and directed by Josh Margolin, and it's freaking great. It's like, and it doesn't surprise me that it got picked up at Sundance. It has definitely been one of the most buzzed about movies. It's got some very nice cinematography from David Bolin, and it should be on your short list if you're looking for something that's feel good and really kind of like you took a caper movie and slowed it way, 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 way down to the geriatric sort of set. There's some jokes in it. Malcolm McDowell's got a wonderful sort of scene towards the end, which he's fantastic.
He's always great. And June Squibb is always great. I mean, June Squibb is a treasure.
Let me tell you, when we're talking about Academy Awards, I think that the Academy's got to be looking at June Squibb for this. Her performance is fantastic.
That's good to hear. Well, yeah, it's on my list and I need to watch it.
Absolutely. So definitely check out Thelma, which I believe you can watch it right now on Amazon for like $6.99 rental. It's totally worth seeing.
Cool. Excellent.
So Ben, where can people find you outside of this show if they want to reach out to you or get some more Ben Rock, you know, on a daily, weekly, monthly basis?
And who wouldn't? Yeah, you can find me at benrock.com. I got a shout out on Twitter from Carlos M, which is at Michael Lost Mind, about my short end last week, which was Tom Vaughn and his story and plot Twitter feed and website. Making friends, because you know Tom Vaughn also saw it and thanked us, so it's all good. Yeah, but anyway, so you can find me at benrock.com. you can go to LinkedIn. Some people been finding me there, most of the social media except TikTok. I did post my first TikTok, but it was a repost of something else. Finally mm-hmm. I broke the seal on TikTok. Don't know if I'll do it again.
Wow. Okay. I feel like this is a milestone for you, Ben.
Yeah. Well, it was an announcement about a film that I wanted to support, and so it was the star/producer of that film, basically plugging that they'd gotten into a film festival. So I will leave it at that. Ilya, where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Red Cameras, hotredcameras.com. This week in Portland, Oregon. I think 2 weeks from now, I'll be back in Los Angeles. So.
Oh, I was about to say, you opened the Portland location? No.
By the time this goes live, I should have some limited hours. I'm really, really, maybe not. Well, before Friday, there'll be limited hours. I'm doing everything I can.
That's a big deal, but it's like a soft opening, and then you're going to do a bigger announcement.
It's a soft opening, and I'm going to be there probably like 2 to 3 hours a day to kind of like, you know, smooth it out. We're still getting our systems in place, but it's frightfully close.
Awesome. So Ilya, who do we have to thank this week?
As always, we have to thank our producer, Alana Cody. Alana, who is doing all of those producer type of things. Oof. To make sure that we have, guests and we have shows and we have cool artwork. And, you know, I think the vast majority of people who hear us or experience our podcast probably are getting it through our RSS feed from either iTunes or Spotify. But if you are one of those people, maybe check out our Instagram, maybe check out our Facebook. You'll get to see all the sort of like extra stuff that Alana does to make sure that, you know, you get a little bit extra flavor of who our guest is. She gets sometimes hundreds, literally hundreds of photos, and she, you know, kind of parses through them and figures out a couple of really good ones to represent. Also, you know, our website, camnoir.com, is sort of like the compendium of all things cinematography podcast. Every single episode there has the show notes. So you can see she writes every single one of those, which are not AI generated. She is going through and writing out all those things. So yeah, she is, you know, making sure that we look and sound our best and giving everyone their due. We also have to thank Michael Dispenza. Michael Dispenza, who is editing this episode and trying to make us not sound like complete idiots. Thank you so much, Michael, for doing your best, Michael.
I'm so sorry about tonight.
And then we also have to thank Kays Alatrachi. Kays, who composed all the music that you heard, our fantastic theme song, our often imitated theme song. I've heard many podcasts out there which seem to have sound-alike music that is...
Wait,
like,
what?
Right, sound alike. It sounds very similar, and like it's not necessarily a cinematography podcast, but I've heard at least two or three other podcasts now where I feel like our music has influenced a podcast or two. I'll just put it that way. So
generation defining music by Kays Alatrachi. You could just say it.
And yeah, you know, and you and I have talked about it several times about that next season, next generation music. We actually have to make that happen. Let's try and do it when I'm in town next time. Let's get together and we will plot out.
Wait, like be in a room with people?
It could happen. I mean, no. I do it every day. It's like, you don't have to just completely isolate yourself from the rest of the world. I mean,
oh man, that's rough. No, let's totally do that. I'll get my my level 4 biocontainment suit ready.
All right, Ben, since you've got the biocontainment suit, that means it's your turn to take us out.
Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, it's not too bad, actually.
I mean, that's just what Alana said a couple of
times. Well, you know what? Thanks for tuning in. It's not the worst thing I've heard. That's not bad. Yeah, okay.
No, I'm down with it.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.